Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Alvaro Jaramillo at Life List, a birding podcast. I'm here with our two other collaborators. Molly Brown is here and George Armisit, and we also have a guest with us today. But first of all, let's just say hello to Molly and George. How are you guys doing?
Good. Yeah,
doing great.
It's wet again here. It's got wet all of a sudden. Beautiful day. Now it's wet.
It's really warm and sunny here. Really? And we had a really nice wave of migration come through last night too. So I know I already told you both this because I was excited and put it in our message for the podcast, but I had my first Louisiana water thrush this morning.
Right.
Outside the door.
So. Very, very apropos, Molly, because we took a little walk down to the woods, Chris and I did, and right as we got to the creek, I was like, you know, this is like perfect time for FOY, Louisiana water thrush. We dipped, but we did have a few other things. But when we got back, I got your message. I was like, there it is. She got one.
Yeah. Funny. I was looking at the eBird line kind of right at the top, which I could see we could be getting things at about the same day. But yeah, I went out and just wanted one new bird. And oof, it's like a holiday to me.
And that sound, one of the best ones.
Yeah.
Here, you know, classic West Coast California migration, you kind of don't really know what's going on. You know, it's sort of like, are they migrating? Maybe. You know, some arrivals are sort of being detected here and there, but just locally, I'm just seeing a few more shorebirds on the beach. But I've not been back that long yet. But before, you know, why don't we introduce our guest here today?
Let's do it.
Let folks know we have Matt Young here, who is the finch guru. The Finch Research Network head. So it's the head fincho, we could say, from Matt.
The Finch Czar, right?
The Finch Czar. Okay. <Yeah. laughs> We could go.
Well, on Facebook, we're Finch Master.
So. Yeah, that's Master. Right. That's right.
But hey, Matt, tell us a little bit more about you and the network, the Finch Network, and let people know what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me on, the three of you. The Finch Research Network, we launched it with the Finch Forecast, the Winter Finch Forecast that a lot of you know, at least here in the eastern part of the United States, in 2020, September 2020, we launched it. I was the founder. We have a board of directors. Tom Hahn from UC Davis is on it. Jamie Cornelius, Oregon State, Tyler Orr, who's the Finch, the Finch forecaster. We also have Holger Klink, who's the director of bioacoustics at Cornell. Tim Spar, kind of my guru partner that's always identifying crossbill call types. Like, he helped out with the Casher crossbill out in California there. Oh, yeah. It's been a lot of fun, and it originated really. It started in a conversation back. I was co-leading a trip with Denver Holt, believe it or not. I was co-leading a Victor Emanuel Nature Tour and Cornell Lab trip, 2014, I think it was, and Denver obviously, founded the Owl Research Institute, and I said, hey,
what he's the Owl Czar, right?
The Owl Czar, exactly. Yeah. So, I was like, what do you think of this idea? And I was with a couple other guys that became really good friends of mine, and they all were pretty positive about it. And then that was 2014, and it was the spring of 2020. Believe it or not, Tim and I and Lance Benner, you might know Lance Alvaro, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did a trip to British Columbia to backtrack Jeff Groth's, who was the original crossbill czar that, described the crossbill call types in the late 80s and early 90s. And we kind of tried to backtrack some of his path in, I think it was the Thompson Plateau in British Columbia. And just trying to find crossbills and seeing where ground zero was for diversity. And so we came out of that trip, and at that time I had shortly thereafter, I'd been offered a position to launch a community-based program for special needs kids. I've worked, a lot of people don't realize this, but I have 15 years at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology in two stints, but I also have 12 to 13 years working with special needs teenagers. Huh. At the same facility, actually, William George Agency for Children's Services. So I've only worked two places, 27 years. I've bounced back and forth between the two. And when I went back to work with the special needs kids, Tim and I were like, you know, let's launch the Finch Research something. It was Tom Hahn that came up with the last piece of the name at UC Davis. It was, we talked about the idea and then he emailed me. He was super stoked about it and said, hey, you know, we could do this, this, and this with this Finch Research Network question mark. And I said to Tom, I emailed him back and said, Tom, you just gave us the last piece of the name because it was either going to be like Finch Research Institute or Initiative. But network seemed to always embody, you know, at least my ethos as far as we want everybody to be part of this thing, whether you're an enthusiast, a researcher, a recordist, an artist, whoever loves finches, it's a big tent.
Yeah. And so, you know, it lends itself well, the group lends itself well to a network because there's a lot of unknowns and there's a lot of things that individual contributors can really sort of say, you know, do something about, like put their little piece in the big puzzle. I don't think you could do that with a lot of, you know, you couldn't do the Warbler network in the same way, you know, it would be different questions, but finches, you know, the fringility, right? The classic finches, goldfinches,
the true finches, fills,
the true finches, the real deal finches. They really are different and weird in a great way. So I think it's fantastic. You have this network and then we can all be sort of a part of it, you know, like often it seems that we're more of an annoyance. We're just sending out recordings and asking like, hey, well, you guys know what this is? Cause you know, you guys know, and I don't, I guess you enjoy it too, to know what these
things are. It's pushed both of us this year because of, you know, when you have an eruption of two different primarily Western call types move to the Northeast. We tend to be a little uber focused on things. I mean, I guess that's maybe a little redundant, but very, very interested in recording everything in the Northeast here. And so, yeah, there's been an onslaught of recordings this year. And the estimates, I've estimated now, I've listened somewhere between 15,000 to 20,000 Red Crossbill recordings, and Tim's over 10,000.
Wow. So
it is a passion and a love.
Yeah.
But each of those recordings is about an hour long.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't get any sleep at all.
I was very, what's the word? You know, this year, listening to some of the crossbills, both of you, you and Tim one time told me, just listen to them. Don't kind of look at the spectrogram all the time, just listen. And I was like, wow, like there's a pitch difference here that I didn't think about before. And I learned things too this year this season, I should say, you know, this winter season that were new to me, because I've always just looked at the picture, you know, just tried to make the spectrogram of these crossbills, try to figure them out.
Yeah. When I teach people, I always try to say, listen first and then do the spec. Because you'll pick up, like you said, there's tonal qualities that you don't get on the spec. It just doesn't. It doesn't have the ability to really pick it up. So I always say listen first, and so you're not biased. Because believe it or not, there's some. Well, you know this, and you probably are going to ask me this. There's some muddiness with crossbills. There's a murky area.
I think it's all. Isn't it all murky?
It is. It is
murky crossbill. Yeah.
I mean,
for the layperson, right, that like has heard, or not even for the layperson, but like we've heard for, you know, 20 years or something now that there's 9 species of crossbills, and everyone's kind of like, it seems like been waiting with bated breath as to what's going to happen. I don't know. if there's a way to summarize things for, you know, overall for folks as to where the, where that, you know, is, but maybe it's a toehold for having, for,
believe it or not. My two areas that I tend to for some reason, I love cryptic species groups. I described a new species of orchid a couple of years ago that was in the Spiranthes group. And that's even more cryptic than crossbills in a lot of ways. But I'm not a proponent, actually, of – I don't think we're going to see some big speciation, you know, species being described in the crossbill, red crossbill complex, to be honest with you. I think it's a panmixia, quite frankly. For those that might not know what that is, it's kind of – I think, you know, populations, you know, they – certain – percentage of a population will break off from time to time. And a cult type can act like a good biological species for, you know, I mean, as a bird goes, generations. And then there's some kind of environmental event that happens or conditions that take place that then forces them back together. It increases hybridization again. And that keeps them from continuing off on their own lineage, in my opinion. Whether that would be, you know, a year where you have mass cone crop failure across a large area, across several conifers, or whether that's a super, super like bumper crop of one species and they're all packed into that one species. Or in the case of, I believe it was called the Badger Fire, in the South Hills, where Casher crossbill is finds its home, you know, 25. I've seen estimates anywhere from 25 to 45 percent of the range burned. I think it was summer 2020 now, and so, you know, you have a fire. You have an island, basically a mountain island, you know, endemic species. That all of a sudden a big percentage of the habitat burns, and what are you going to get? You know, you're going to get some wandering probably, even if, you know, they're known as a resident, you know, call type. I mean, you know, I think a lot of things we often, all of us love to put these things in boxes. And I think when you kind of really step back, you know, let the species do its thing and observe and think about it. They'll figure it out. I think species in general, we are a lot more resilient and opportunistic when you actually start to observe what's going on.
You know, I think you're, I buy into what you're saying that, you know, so we have these multiple, you know, what, 12 now types in North America, is it? And yet I do think like this division of Casha and rest of red doesn't quite make sense to me as much as maybe if we had three species, you know, maybe the little billed guys or something like that. I really do get worked up about the fact that there's these little billed guys and these big billed guys. And then sometimes they're actually, you know, in the same state or even same county breeding. And you're like, gosh, boy, that sure does look like a species level thing. I'm not, you know, the fact that all, you know, all the big build guys, you know, I could sort of see them being, you know, yeah, you know, maybe more fluid. I don't know. There's a weird aspect of the morphology of these small guys. When you see them, you're like, wow, look at that. You know, that's not. Yeah. So I do wonder if there's sort of like almost like a happy medium in there. You know, we might end up with three species or four, I mean, but not 12, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, you're in an area where type three, you're on the West Coast, so type three is pretty common. That's the small build guy.
Yeah.
You know, it has a smaller build than white wing crossbill. White wing crossbill is basically it's type three, and then white wing crossbill is the next right. Smallest. And then I think it's type 10, which is also your area where you see them. And, you know, I don't, and then there's several medium bill birds, but you got to remember there's overlap in the bill sizes,
right?
A continuous overlap in the bill sizes. If you look at the whole complex, there's nobody that's like, they group out entirely based on bill. So like the largest type three will overlap with the smallest of the medium billed birds.
Right.
And the largest of the medium billed birds will overlap with the smallest of the largest billed birds. So I get what you're saying is like, will they separate out? And the thing is with the soft bill, particularly with type three, I mean, there's the way I've kind of described this now, and I might get, a little bit of, hopefully not too much backlash, but I kind of see there being three different groups with different life, like history strategies per se. Uh-huh. You have the ones that have bigger bills typically are these pine, loving species.
Right. Sort of hard cone. Big pine, ponderosa pine kind of thing.
Yeah. And so, there's two ways crossbills kind of form residency or quasi-residency. And that's, do you have a single reliable, cone crop for one species? Like lodgepole pine. Type 5 doesn't really – I know we're getting in the weeds right out of the gate here, but type 5 is, doesn't really move around much. I mean, it's a lodgepole pine – bird mostly, although it loves Engelmann spruce as well. They're a lot more adaptable to different conifers than they're given credit for. And, there's not a lot of movement, not a lot of, nomadic behavior with type 5. And Cassia crossbill, even though we're obviously seeing it move around now, for all intents and purposes, is a relatively resident or doesn't really move too much. So you kind of have type 5, lodgepole pine bird, and type 9, which is Cassia crossbill, which is also a lodgepole pine bird. There's a theme here. So lodgepole pine produces one of the most reliable cone crops in the world. So don't have to move.
Yeah.
Now type 3, which is a small billed bird, and type 4, which is a medium billed bird, they're largely at least been documented to be, or at least the thought is they're most closely associated type 3 with Western hemlock, type 4 with Douglas fir. They're highly nomadic.
And these are little cones, pretty soft cones, from what,
Exactly.
For the Eastern people who might not know what a Western hemlock looks like.
Yeah, we have our Eastern hemlock here, which is very similar morphologically.
Getting hit hard by a blight right now, but
exactly. So then you have kind of these nomadic, to me, ones that, are at least, studies have shown them to be more closely associated with species that don't form reliable cone crops from year to year. And that would be two threes and fours. Two threes and fours move around the country. In fact, it's kind of funny. I mean, I often refer to type two as the eclectic crossbill. Or Tom Hahn will say it's the eat everything crossbill.
Eat everything.
sorry, which type is that?
Type two. Everything. Type two.
Which is a larger billed bird, most closely associated with ponderosa pine. But two, threes, and fours move all over the country. And so is specialization the key there? It's hard to – I don't know if it is. I think the nomadic behavior and the fact that they're conifer switching throughout the year is super important there. And so the other way crossbills can form residency or quasi-residency is if you have an area or – of conifers and a diversity of conifers in a given area that kind of there's always something on the menu for them that have different cone ripening phenologies. So the soft cone conifers that the Doug fir, the hemlocks, they form cone crops, May, June, July, they ripen, the food's available right away. Spruce, same thing. And then you have these kind of semi-soft cone conifers, which is Doug fir and the white pine group, limber pine, white pine. And then you have the hard cone conifers, which are, lodgepole pine, ponderosa pine, red pine, jack pine, Monterey pine, which is another serotonous species, meaning that the cones are encased in a gelatinous, like a gel. So those environments – those cones don't really get accessible unless there's high heat, fire-driven ecosystems. So if you have a crossbill and that, there's different conifer diversity that has different ripening phenologies, there's always something on the menu.
Right.
And they're going to move around to find those particular species.
It seems almost like what you've just said kind of explains why we can't easily understand this as birders in a way, because you're sort of saying some of these birds are actually specializing and the other ones aren't. You know what I mean? Right. So you have both extremes in the one group and you're like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. That's why type twos are kind of, you know, moving around and they can do this and that and see them in different trees. You know, I don't have any ponderosa pines around here, yet they do fine. Yeah. Then, yeah, it's kind of interesting in that way. Now, I want to backtrack a bit and say, maybe introduce to people this kind of concept that birders might have not thought about, and that most birds that eat seeds, right? Like, let's say, a lot of the sparrows are eating seeds, you know, in the winter and so on. In the breeding season, they don't eat seeds. They eat, you know, bugs and so forth. But a lot of these true finches actually eat the seeds all year round. Not always, right? Not all of them. But I think that is key, isn't it, to kind of why we have these crossbills that are specializing, or, you know, and that they will feed actual, you know, pine seeds to the young in the nest, right?
They basically feed a regurgitate, basically, like a pulp.
Okay.
Back to the young, that they've somewhat, they've digestive enzymes that start to break that down. And they,
it sounds really good.
Doesn't it? I mean, it sounds yummy to me whenever I'm in a conifer forest. But you're right. And I think the ones that probably eat the seeds the most, I was just looking at this last night, are the crossbills and probably the goldfinches.
Right.
Because Lawrence's goldfinches is kind of a fiddle neck specialist. In a sense. And, you know, even the American goldfinch, lesser goldfinch, a lot of thistle or, you know, native thistles, thistles. Now, the other ones, you know, I do want to say to everybody that, you know, crossbills do eat insects more than people realize. Right. Again, this gets back to that opportunistic kind of mindset. I think these birds are a lot more flexible than we give them credit for. But, I mean, you're not going to have a bill that crosses and not be specialized for feeding on seeds and conifers. That's right. What makes crossbills so amazing. And, you know, that's why I anybody that hasn't heard any of my presentations, I was a hydrogeologist, meteorologist, undergrad major. And I realized at the end of my undergraduate at SUNY Oneonta that I didn't want to go into that field, because the main job in that field at the time was something called LUST. It was the assessment of leaky underground storage tanks.
Oh, okay. I was confused at first.
Yeah, exactly. somewhat on purpose. But anyway, and it was, you know, that last semester at SUNY Oneonta, I decided that I would start to take up bird watching. I actually took a continuing ed class at an Audubon person taught. And so I bought a pair of binoculars, bought a car, went to a Grateful Dead concert, got up the next day, and drove to a job as a host in a Lake Yellowstone Inn in Yellowstone. And it was my first day at Yellowstone. I grabbed the binoculars, went to Lower Falls, and a flock of crossbills flew in and started feeding.
Yeah.
And that's where it all started.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. You know, talk about spark, right? You never looked, you were like, this is all I want to watch, crossbills. Yeah, warblers everywhere else and all these. Yeah. This is it. But I'm glad you did. I'm glad that you and the other finch networkers have specialized, because it really is one of the most crazy sort of situations in birding in North America. Well, all of in the entire Northern Hemisphere, to be thinking of these finches and then you have the crossbills, and then you start looking at pine grosbeaks and evening grosbeaks, and then there's call types there, and then, you know, West Coast versus East Coast purple finches, and it starts going like, okay, what is going on here? You know, your mind starts going, these are interesting birds. There's questions to be addressed here that are cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating things with finches. So yeah, there's five call types of evening grosbeaks. We, in the book that Lillian and I have coming out in September, Finches, United States and Canada, we actually have a spectrograph of the differences in the East Coast and the West Coast purple finches as well. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty different sounding. You've probably keyed into them, but they're really, really different sounding. Pine grosbeaks are kind of interesting. Atkinson did this amazing, you know, there really hasn't been a lot of research done on pine grosbeak over the last, I'd say, 40, 50 years at this point. But Atkinson was the one that kind of did a lot of the vocal analysis.
That was like in the 70s, late 70s or something? Yeah. Okay.
And I should add that Atkinson was Groth's master's student advisor at Virginia Tech. So there's a lineage amongst us, you know, loxiophiles or finchophiles, whatever you want to call us. I don't think the call type thing really exists in a lot of the finches.
Right.
It does seem to exist, obviously, in red crossbill, but it doesn't exist in white-winged crossbill. It doesn't exist, I believe, in, like, you know, the house finches or the purple finch, Cassin finch, I should say. Purple finch, it definitely does. And the interesting thing is when you step back and look at the call type thing, with pine grosbeak, there seems to be kind of clusters. Mm-hmm. The two northern ones, you know, the eastern one does this most, you know, a lot of times people here are the kind of lesser yellow legs, 222.
Yeah.
The western ones, except for the northern ones, I think it's subspecies Montana, which is the Rocky Mountain bird. And then there's Flammula, that's kind of the Pacific Northwest bird. You know, they will give some of those kind of 222 calls, but they give a more modulated two note call. And they don't give as many of those whistled yellow legs type calls. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't seem to be a clear, like, call type thing in pine grosbeaks, other than there's some similarities in the eastern bird is different than the western birds. And where the ranges meet,
right,
there might be some learning going on, and there's, you know, some overlap there.
And I think that's also an interesting thing to kind of talk about with you and let people know that these call types that these crossbills have are actually learned call types, right? So
yes.
they're not like flycatchers, you know, where you have the, you know, willow and alder that they have these really specific call types that they don't learn and they really, you know, they don't kind of understand each other. And isn't it true that also within a pair or family group, the calls are actually more similar to each other than they are to the rest of the flock? Like there's some level of cultural cohesion that might be going on here with these calls.
Yeah. In particular especially with crossbills, which is a great example. And that's where this has been studied probably the most at this point, is when there's good conditions for breeding, a pair will go through a period of call modification. Mm-hmm. Where they can kind of converge on a very, very similar, you know, flight call, both in sound and in the spectrograph. And so, yeah, they go through a period of learning and kind of call modification where they end up with the same. Now, the interesting thing is it doesn't seem like all pairs do it.
Right.
We're not really sure. And, you know, there have been... you know, Craig Benkman, who's studied, you know, Cassia crossbill and who's written, has done a lot to advance, you know, what we know about crossbills. You know, in, you know, the South Hills, there were a handful. He had like over 2,000 mark recapture birds, and there were a handful that were known to switch their call.
Huh.
So that's where, you get this murkiness, this muddy. So I, you know, when people send me recordings, I always say there's about 5%, maybe a little more for some of the call types, maybe even up to 10%, where I just kind of shrug my shoulders and go, I think we got to leave this as Red Cross Bill, because,
right,
you know, when they're going through that kind of pair bond thing and they're, you know, call matching, that's where you get a lot of these weird variants.
Huh.
And so, yeah, go ahead, Alvaro.
Do the pairs, is there any evidence that these pairs will stay together for more than one season, like multiple years of the same male-female pair?
Yes, and that's where this call matching phenomenon seems to be even more
consistent. Are you talking about just Red Cross Bills right now?
In this case, I'm just talking Red Cross Bills because there hasn't been really
It's hard to picture some of the smaller finches,
Red poles don't really seem to do a call type thing. And I mean, look at rosy finches, which, you know, it's very rare to have three well-accepted species at this point, and they almost have no vocalization differences.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, your head just kind of, my head explodes when I think about that one sometimes.
Yeah, and rosy finches, to me, I feel like, okay, so we pick these three to separate, but then, you know, the Hepburns and the St. Paul, the Pribilof one seems so different to me that I'm like
20%.
You're
going
to split these three, you got to do the other ones.
Yeah.
You know, that might be coming down the road. I mean, there's possibly some evidence there that the Aleutian Pribilof, birds, they're so much bigger.
They're like thrush sized. Yeah.
They're nesting at sea level. They're nesting in
underneath almost too.
And they're nesting in like shacks, not on mountains. Mm-hmm. And that was, from my understanding, that was one of the things that kind of showed differences was a gene. And again, I'm not a geneticist, but it was a gene that basically showed how they differed in their ability to deal with oxygen-limited environments.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get up 14,000 feet, you know, there's genes that give the ability for those birds to be able to function at that level. Whereas, it's pretty wild. I just got back from looking at – we were just out doing some – banding and tagging, satellite tagging, and the sunbird tags on evening grosbeaks out west. And I was looking at some gray crowns and some Hepburns. I miss Black Rosy. That's an amazing. But yeah, this Road to Recovery project with evening grosbeaks, we just did our first leg out west in Utah, middle of nowhere, Utah, Altona, Utah.
I was wondering if there was actually a place called Middle of Nowhere, Utah, because that would be a really cool place to visit.
Yeah, it was beautiful. We were surrounded by the mountains, but we were in this ag land with type ones and four evening grosbeaks coming in. And so we were tagging, putting these sunbird tags on birds.
Evening grosbeaks will go up to which moth is it? The tent caterpillar? Is that right? Don't they?
It's budworm. They're budworm.
Budworm. That's what I'm thinking. Budworms. Yeah. That's interesting too. That there's one of these finches that's, you know, has this other kind of food choice that they make.
Yeah. So evening grosbeaks. I mean, these spruce, which is a native species, a lot of people don't realize that spruce budworm is a native species. And so evening grosbeaks, we know population cycle somewhat with the budworm outbreaks. And purple finch and pine siskins also utilize, again, this gets back to that opportunistic. I think if you give most species, you know, a really abundant, protein-rich, slow, easy to feed on, food source, they're going to take advantage of that. Yeah. And crossbills have been known to even have budworm in their stomachs. So, grosbeaks in particular and purple finches as well are definitely budworm specialists, like the budworm warblers.
Right.
So
interesting,
Matt. You were talking about sort of the kind of the learned aspect of these finch vocalizations and the plasticity, I guess, of some of the species and their calls. But there's quite a few finches that actually engage in mimicry, right?
Oh, like, good question, because I had that in my questions here.
Yeah, like purple finches, lesser goldfinches. Those are the first two that come to mind. But there's others, and like I think like do Western
Hawaiian honey finches, creepers.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Like, but I bet that there's some. I bet that basically that's unknown. So what's going on there, and what? You know, what's known about that, and how do you think that evolves? What role does it play, if any?
Well, the fascinating, we cover this actually, and it's one of the topics that I list as one of the top topics that for research. It's a research area that needs additional studies. We list this in the book. So we cover like the main 18 breeding species in the book, and then we cover honey creepers.
Who's the publisher for the book?
It's a Stokes Guide. It's with Lillian. It's Hachette Publishing or Little Brown and Company.
Nice.
So it's Lillian's 36th book, awesome. Which is just, you know,
it's amazing.
It's amazing to bring this passion and I've had for, you know, 30 years now. It's like my life's work that it's just, it's yeah. So great to be able to do this with Lillian. It's been a joy. But back to your question, George, is, you know, this is an area that needs research. And the thing that's so fascinating about this question to me, and this is why it needs to be researched, you know, and there's not a great idea. Like they used to think like mimicry in mockingbirds was a sign of fitness, I believe. And I think they've backed off of that some. In recent years, it's not entirely understood why imitation of other birds, why certain species do it. But you're right, with finches, you have amazing mimicry in Lawrence's and lesser goldfinch. But get this, none in American goldfinch.
Right.
You get amazing mimicry in Cassin's finch, yeah. Purple finch, but none in house finch.
Yeah.
So, and those are the descendants. So you don't know if it's some reason to diversify? It's another layer of diversification from.
I have a theory.
Go ahead. I'd love to hear it.
So like in the honey creepers, which are actually finches, right? They have the loud song that they don't mimic in. And then they have these soft songs, like low volume, close proximity
whisper songs
where they mimic. If I watch my purple finches in the backyard here, it's similar. The big loud song that you hear all the time, no mimicry. Then there's a secondary song that often is given at sort of half volume that has got a different set of parameters in it. And that's where they mimic. And I think like the loud song is sort of territorial. It's I'm here, this is whatever. But the other song is probably more to, you know, mate attraction. Like one of them's more for the general sort of like, stay out of here. And the one where they mimic is more like, hello, you know, what's your name? kind of thing. Yeah. It's sort of the, yeah. the speed dating kind of song. But there's an element of
it's more conversational. It's less.
It's more about pair bonding, and the first song is more about territoriality. Mm-hmm. And there may be mixes there.
I like this album.
I think you're on to something, and that I've talked about a few different times with others. And I've talked to Nathan Peeplow. He's another one that's great with vocalizations of species. And so my thought on this is you're right or half right. I don't know where the truth is at this point.
We need to take any element of right.
I was gonna say, that's more than he usually gets. So we'll take it.
Yeah. we sip a beer, and maybe you'll be even more right, So their stereotypical song, which seems to be kind of fixed and louder, and it's territorial based. I don't know if it doesn't have anything to do with the Parabon, though I think it probably does, because finches actually aren't really known to be protective of like a given area. They're kind of colonial or semi-colonial nesters a lot of times. And so what they do is they kind of move around an area where the female is, even when they're given this kind of louder, stereotypical, fixed song, that you know they're breeding. Now, George, you said, I've always called, you're right. So when finches are in flocks, you see this early on with goldfinches and siskins and crossbills and pine grosbeaks. They're social. And so they're given this long conversational song that is almost open-ended. And they're doing the mimicry in that. And it's often at half volume. So I call that conversational song a lot of times to people when they're in the flocks. And Alvaro, to give you a little more right, they might very well be singing particularly to one female in that flock. But how do you tweak that out isn't super easy. Because these birds, finches, often form pair bonds within flocks, within social flocks. So they could be very well, like, I don't know, sweet talking kind of conversational song where they're just doing this incredible mimicry as part of that pair bond. I don't know. I mean, it'd be a great experiment.
Do females sing in the finch?
I was wondering about that as well.
They do, actually. In fact, I had a female Red Crossbill in the Adirondacks just recently that was singing. I mean, unless it was some odd. So how you tell crossbills, a lot of people don't realize this. They'll see like, you know, a yellow bird and they'll say it's a female. A lot of times you can get young yellow looking males.
Right.
It's the lack of color on the throat that you can tell the female Red Crossbill from a male Red Crossbill that might be yellow. So it's always good to keep that in mind. But a lot of the females in finches will sing some. I think it's known in purple finch. It's known in red crossbill. It's known in pine grosbeak, I believe. It's known in at least half of them, I think, where the finches will sing some. It's not at the same kind of intensity a lot of times. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating that they...
With the whole idea of vocal mimicry and purple finches, do eastern purple finches mimic a lot or some or none?
I don't know if you'd call it mimicry, but you certainly hear them doing like vireo sounds and other sounds that certainly
but the vireo song is actually just a song that sounds like a vireo.
It's right? A different it's thing.
Yeah.
Because it's a different...
Yeah, in the ahead. West, they mimic. Like, you know, you'll get...
Right.
You know, I have them in my backyard, and they're doing, you know, Stellar's Jays and all sorts of other stuff. You know,
no, the Eastern one does the same. I gotta say, they don't seem to do it. It's an earlier season thing, and they don't seem to do it with a ton of regularity. But when you get a bird that's mimicking others, they really are great. They're great at mimicking others. Pine siskins are a great mimic too.
Yeah.
I mean, but red poles don't really mimic, it seems.
Right.
So it's kind of, again, and then you take evening grosbeak. Do they even have a song?
Huh.
That's wild.
Think about that. About it, I mean, we think they do, but they kind of string together like predictable phrases of trills and calls more so like within the first couple hours after dawn kind of thing. So we do, I mean, Nathan wrote a really nice ear birding piece on this that, you know, him and I talked about.
It's a good site for folks that don't know, right? Earbirding.com.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I can't promote Nathan's stuff enough.
Really. Yeah. He does great work.
Absolutely. So,
So for me, like a very personal question, Kasha Crossbill, right? we had these, I guess one or more, it's hard to tell because there's, you know, birds in a flock, but at least one bird identified as Cacha crossbill here, and you know, just a few miles from my house this winter, this season. And one of the things that the local birders and I guess the committee, you know, eventually in California, because it's a new bird for the state, is can you say it really was a Cacha crossbill, or given that they learn the songs, but also given that at least some of the recordings were sort of dead on, you know, like some of the recordings were a little, you know, iffy, you know, different, or just they were distant, or you know, just not quality. But the real quality recordings seem to show at least one bird that is dead on for Cacha crossbill. Is that to you enough to say yes, a bird that came from that population did actually arrive in California? I know it's kind of putting you on the spot, but you know, and you can waffle with it too if that's fine. You know, that's fine with us. We waffle.
No waffling, man.
If we're going to acknowledge that call types are a type of honest signaling, for people that might not know, you know, honest, you know, are these call types, is learning fixed to some degree? And you know, there's some mixture on that out there as far as like how far can a crossbill learn another call. And there certainly have been rare circumstances, very rare circumstances, where they have been known to kind of, you know, alter their call to sound like another. Now, this isn't that crazy if you think about it from all the song learners, the passerines. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have we heard the odd warbler song or the odd sparrow song? Mm-hmm. If you step back and really think of it, I heard one time a yellow rump singing almost a spot on black-throated blue warbler. I watched the bird sing.
Oh yeah.
So it's not that abnormal, but I think you had more than one Cacha crossbill in that flock. I mean, it seemed like there were a few birds in there. And if we're going to recognize call types as a thing, you had Cacha crossbill there. Right. Now that gets into a whole another debate. Should call types be recognized as a species? Now, Jeff Hill, you know, last year, we're getting in a little bit of the weeds on the classifications. You know, there was, you know, the history of Cacha crossbill is Craig, you know, he found it, I think it was around the late 1990s. He did this incredible recapture study, put a tremendous amount of work into it. You know, this is a bird that largely doesn't move around. It feeds on this, you know, local variant of lodgepole pine. It breeds in a fixed time period of year, unlike most other crossbills. It was assortatively mating with its own call type 99% of the time, even though type 2s and 5s were coming in and out of the area. When he proposed it, the first vote, you know, he first proposed it as the South Hills crossbill, mm-hmm. and it was a hung vote. It was basically a split vote. You need 2/3, is it, on the committee there for it to pass. And then one of the knocks against it, there wasn't enough specimens, I guess. So then, you know, he did some more work on it, and then it passed. But then Jeff Hill, who's a house finch researcher, and a lot of, I think it's Jeff Hill, Jeffrey Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a woodpecker researcher as well.
Yep, right? Ivory billed guy. Yep. And so, you know, he came out, you know, he put in a proposal a year and a half ago now, that call type should not be recognized at the species level because it could be, I think, you know, again, I'm not a geneticist, but I think what he said is that, you know, flight call or vocalizations can also be on another, like genes can fix for multiple variables. And so vocalization could be one of those things. Like with red poles, I think the deal is there's a continuous overlapping variation with the red poles. And so Jeff said, you know, he put in a proposal saying that this shouldn't be recognized as a species. And then it was, the vote went from a split vote the first time to like an 8-2 vote when it passed, to when Jeff put in proposal saying it should be lumped back in with Red Cross bill, it then went from an 8-2 vote to a 6-4 vote. So this, you know, these are humans trying to, you know, make some sense of this stuff and classify and categorize it. So
sounds like all square pegs and round holes to me.
I think the original info is, I mean, you've got some solid stuff. You have Sympatric, you know, you have the other types are there. They're actually mating, you said 90-something%.
99%.
That's way better than a lot of warblers, you know, and or hummingbirds. I mean, that's pretty strong to me. Like, that's solid. If one of the crossbills was red and the other one was, you know, bright yellow, nobody would have a problem with the fact that they look alike is the thing that makes people go nuts, right?
Yeah, these cryptic species. Yeah. You know, now does the fact that they're wandering around more now, does that change the dynamic? Possibly.
It doesn't to me. I mean, I find it hard to believe a crossbill is ever like resident. You know what I mean? Like, to me, it's like crossbills maybe have built a residency in. Period, you know, maybe 20, 30 years sometimes, you know, and then suddenly something happens and they move. That's part of being a crossbill. It just sort of seems, you know, unless you're on Hispaniola, you know, then you're kind of stuck, you know.
An amazing bird.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a, you know, glacial relic of white-winged crossbill that's got a bigger bill. It doesn't really have much of a song. Looks like a white-winged crossbill. Feeds on pine. Yeah.
I'd love to see it one day. I got to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great bird. I haven't seen it myself, so. Yeah. Fascinating.
So, changing questions for everybody. Is there a finch? And maybe you could go even worldwide or North America-wide that you would love to see that sort of attracts your attention. Molly, do you have anything comes to mind? Any or one finch that you sort of like in North America that just sort of, you know, it's your fave finch?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. What I really want to see are the rosy finches. I've only seen right now. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the rosy finches. So that's a really easy answer. And ones that I would like to clean up.
Yeah, yeah. I got to say that when black rosy finch was the one that really was like, wow. I was not wowed by the brown capped as much. I don't know why, but the black rosy finch was like, ooh, that's a pretty looking bird.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, that's definitely high on my wish list for the U.S.
I think it's the nicest looking of the three, but
yeah.
I mean, it's a slick bird. But yeah, close to home, purple finches are just absolutely a delight. They're rare enough through here that, you know, I don't get to see them every day.
Right. And so it's a special. Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, George?
It's a good question.
You know, because we it's so in the weeds, you know, talking about it, you know, sometimes you're like, okay, what's a cool finch you want to see one day or that you see every day? But
there's so many Asian finches. That I'd like to see, rose finches. I mean, some of the ones you see on your Japan tour were some of my, was long-tailed rose finch and,
right.
That's a beautiful bird. And Pallas's rose finch. Like, I feel like the finches really come into their own in Asia.
That's the thought that, you know, where the honey creepers came from was a flock of common rose finches. You know, 5 million years ago, wandered off and landed in Hawaii. And then we had this incredible adaptive radiation to 50-something species that a lot of the bills evolved to not even look like what we all grew up, or most of us grew up, a lot of us grew up to think was a finch, you know, bill.
Right.
And and if Darwin landed there, that would have got a lot more attention. When we were talking about real finches, not tanagers.
Yeah, right. That's Darwin's fake finches in the Galapagos, you know. And, you know, the Darwin's finches are pretty neat, cool, but they're not beautiful. You know, they're sort of like, you know.
Really cryptic.
Right. Yet in Hawaii, those guys are amazing. The ones, you know, that. The few that are left are still so amazing.
Oh, this is one I was trying to think of. I was trying to remember the name. Is Sillam's rose finch. which is Sillam's rose finch, for which is data deficient. It's like a Tibetan plateau thing, and there's a few records from Ladakh and some from, you know, in China. But like, there's 19 eBird photos, one audio recording, and there's some very good photos actually. But
I gotta look.
It's
up
not particularly. It's not a. It's as finches go, it's not the snazziest one. It is. It's a Carpedacus, it's basically the you know, in their bright adult plumage, they're basically gray with a brown head, but just cool, such a, you know, little known bird. But I remember up in Ladakh having that in mind as like, you know, a white whale to find up there.
A white whale. You know, one of the ones I actually gotten to see, you know, reasonably regularly in the last few years because of Japan is hawfinch. And hawfinch is, you know, what really gets me about it? It's not only that it's a big build kind of, you know, it's this kind of big head, big body, short tail thing, but it has these really, really weird, like, it's not really the tertials, but it's almost like the inner primaries or something. They flare out.
Yeah,
and you
totally
you
weird.
See that, and
they must create
like,
some kind of sound, or it must be used in display somehow, right? Because that's totally different.
Yeah. Totally different. And the moment you see that, you can't unsee it, and you're like, wow. Like, you thought the bill was going to be that thing that gets you, but then you see these little feathers on the, and you're like, what the heck is that? You know, like, why'd you do that?
Got to make
that?
Some kind of mechanical Evolution? Sound or something.
Yeah. I haven't seen hawfinch. I would love to see hawfinch. I mean, I know it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, we think it's closely related to our evening grosbeak and hooded grosbeak.
Right.
So.
It's Cocothraustes.
Cocothraustes, yeah. Although there's a proposal to, I think keep that one, Cocothraustes, but R2 here in the States and Mexico, Hesperophona again.
Yeah.
I think that's the proposal.
Yeah,
that I saw for this year, which, you know, Redpoll's also being is proposed now to be lumped.
Yep, that's going to be a lump. And by the way, you know, for folks who travel around a lot, euphonias are and chlorophonias are part of the group too, right?
Such a great group of birds too.
Yeah, they're finches. We used to think they were tanagers, and now we know they're finches. And when you realize that they're,
you start to hear them, you're like, those are homologous like finch thing. Calls. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it's when people ask me, you know, sometimes when I do these interviews, these podcasts and stuff, and they'll like, what makes a finch a finch? Is it the bill? And I'm like, that's what we used to think. But now with genetics, you know, it kind of, there isn't really like one thing that you can hang your hat on as far as like what makes a finch a finch. You're right with the calls, the social contact calls, although other, you know, sparrows do social contact calls too,
right?
To some degree, at least. So,
I was just, you know, leading a trip a few weeks ago in Chile and Argentina, and one of the things that so 2 years in a row now I've seen this the siskins down there, you know, which are really goldfinches, goldfinchy things, you know, the hooded siskins. There's these sort of lowland hooded siskins that are really bright, and then I've been seeing these highland hooded siskins that are a different subspecies that are really green. And you could probably see the two in the same day if you tried. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, there's a lot to be done here to figure out all these South American and Central American siskin species, because there's more than meets the eye.
Yeah, I think in the same thing across Eurasia, you're going to, once people really start to dive into this stuff.
Green finches.
There's a lot of diversity that has yet to be described. There's a lot to learn still with this incredible social, you know, this group of social species that are just amazing.
One of my favorite finch names is Himalayan Beautiful Rose Finch.
Or Himalayan.
Oh, he's got it. Yeah. Hey, Matt, before we're getting close to our time here, coming up on the hour, one thing very curious to ask you about one of your other recent media appearances. You made a cameo on the Early Worm Gets the Bird series. You guys, folks, I know a lot of our listeners are aware of these guys because I've gotten a lot of messages about them. They're pretty funny. But yeah, they, what was that like? What was that experience like?
Yeah. So we were working on the Evening Grose Peak Road Recovery Project in Saxim. And I was, I was hanging out with Sparky Stensis, who was the executive director there. And they had kind of arranged to kind of connect up there. So, that, they're trying to see as many. They're basically, my gist, and we had some nice back and forth kind of comedic jabs at one another. Obviously, they showed me it as like a Bob's Burger guy or something. Yeah, I think that's what it was. They're like Finch expert Matt Young. They're a blast. I mean, I think they're funny. It's not for everybody. It's that what Letterkenny kind of humor, slap shot. If everybody remembers the movie,
yeah, the hair is definitely very reminiscent of slap shot.
Yeah. So. In our barbs back and forth there, I said, you guys are pretty funny for our hockey players, because they were both hockey players that are no longer playing hockey. So my understanding is like they were like, what are we going to do? And we're like, well, we'll go, around the country and see as many birds as we can and kind of make some humor out of that. And so that's kind of where that back and forth came from. But I think they're great. I think we got to laugh at ourselves sometimes and be able to laugh at things. But yeah, I did a cameo there. I don't know if we want to I was one of the highlights of my year was speaking at Frontiers, the symposium as well, which was where I met both, Molly and George in person finally.
Lifers.
Lifers. Exactly. So yeah, Frontiers Symposium for Youth and Ornithology. And I don't know if you want to mention anything about that, Molly, or
sure. Yeah. We were just talking about this in a meeting the other night for Frontiers. But we talked about the symposium a lot before it happened in November. And our third symposium, or sorry, when did that happen? Was that November?
Early November.
Our first one was in September. It threw me off. Anyway, our next symposium is happening in 2025 in November, so we'll be having details on that. But in the meantime, we're rolling out something that we've wanted to do since we started the organization, which is what we're calling Frontiers Institutes, which are one-day events that are meant for small groups to be hands-on experiences and exploring different career paths in ornithology or conservation science or related pursuits. So those are all created by partnering with another organization, and we're starting to roll them out this summer. So that's what Matt and I have been working on that front too.
Nice.
And getting those plans made. Yeah, it's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah, definitely. We're on the board together, Molly and I, so it's exciting. It's great, with these two different interests of mine, and Holly Merker, as we all know, is a friend of, I think, all of us out there. It's my area of interest, where I am still both a social worker and an ornithologist, is kind of that, wellness around what we all do. I just think scientists need to get more and more, or birders need to get more and more comfortable with, why do we do what we do? And we don't do this just for the data. We do this because we love it.
Right.
And we do it because it makes us feel good and makes us feel like keeps us kind of, in a healthy state.
Yeah. Feeds the soul. Mind.
Exactly. Yeah, it feeds the soul. And so, I will. You'll continue to hear me plug that whenever anybody is going to willing to have me on. So,
I also want to plug you guys do the Finch forecast, and I was a good friend, Ron Pittaway's back. He was kind of a mentor of mine as a teen birder. He was the guy that started this, and to me, there is such genius in this concept of like, look at the trees, what's going on broad scale, and predict what the finches might do. And you get, you know, it comes out every year before sort of in the fall season, right? Sort of right before.
Yeah, it's winter. Like end of September.
Yep. End of September. So yep. I would have folks go and search this out, you know, either, you know, look for the Finch Research Network or, you know, the Finch Forecast to get the latest that's coming up. And I hear that you're going to start forecasting stock market too. Is that right? You guys are, you know, based on no,
I wish I could. But seriously, about the Finch Research Network. In fact, we have this on the website. If it wasn't for Ron Pittaway, starting this love and passion for finches that goes back decades now, we would not have had the traction that we have today with, right, you know, this widespread love. So we lost a great one, in my opinion, when we lost Ron. Tyler's incredible to work with. And it's great that he kind of takes the lead on the Finch Forecast. And
you kept it in Canada too, which is good. You know, it's like,
we did. Yeah. That was very important to Ron, and it was great to, so when we're, you know, obviously when Ron decided to step down, you know, he introduced Tyler and I, because I was doing the crossbill piece for years, for better part of a decade for the Forecast. And it's great talking to, it's great doing it with Tyler, because it's we have a lot of fun. We're about the same age, so we get the same humor. Yeah. And he's a hockey lover also. He's a big hockey fan. I'm a hockey fan. So we're always kind of, you know, he's a Lightning fan, believe it or not, Tampa Bay Lightning. I'm an Islanders fan.
Oh, boy, the Islanders. For shame. For shame, Matt.
Well, hey.
It's been a tough road for the Flyers the last decade, but things are maybe turning around.
Yeah, you have a good coach in there now. We'll see how long he lasts, though. He doesn't seem to last too long.
Yeah, that's not his forte, sticking around. But
No. But hey, the Islanders have the best dynasty in any sport ever, in my opinion.
That's a strong case can be made. Yeah.
that's why I was originally an All-State basketball, honorable mention All-State basketball player. So I was a sports guy growing up. And it was around the late 70s when I was just old enough to kind of get into all the sports, and the Islanders were a great dynasty there in the late 70s, early 80s. So
small forward, shooting guard.
I was a shooting guard. I at one point I hit six threes and a half.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But right when I held the record for the conference for a little while, but you know, I was like, I think when I was in high school, they had just implemented the 3-point line, like a few years before. I was a baseball player and a basketball player. So now I'm more of a bird nerd and a social worker. So
social working bird nerd.
I know this is
where you get to contribute, like, amazingly so, you know, to the world. I really want to thank you for all the work you've done to educate all of us. Thousands of people out there who are, you know, reading about or learning about crossbills, or having, you know, crossbills identified, or you know, the Finch Forecast. It's just amazing what you guys have done with basically, all, you know, really almost a volunteer kind of effort. It's fantastic. We thank you a lot for that. And thank you, too, for coming out to talk to us.
Thanks, Matt, for doing this. I feel like we've been talking about it for months, and
we really have.
Yeah, yeah. It's like trying to get everybody together was the trickiest part. But we knew it would be interesting.
I was making notes in the background because I thought this could easily become a 2-parter episode, but I'm sure we can fill a second episode very quickly.
Yeah. Hey, I would love to plug the book. So if you want to have me, have Lillian and I on. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Lillian and I would love to be on.
That would be fantastic. Yeah.
Once the book is out. That comes out, it's, you can get it on pre-order now on Amazon, but it'll be out September 17th.
And it'll have, I imagine, great photographs and sort of notes on the different types and ranges and kind of and the biology, kind of a little bit of everything that we've been talking about today, right? Sort of.
We approach this, she calls it a book that she's never really done before. We tried to really do the deep dive on the science, but we, you know, we wanted to make it interesting for the kind of novice.
Yeah, right.
And we said, how can we do this? And so, you know, we were like, can there be some kind of introduction narrative to describe the personality of these finches? Kind of like a Bent Life History account. I mean, I love those old Bent Life History
amazing
accounts.
Books. Yeah,
amazing books. So she wrote these things called Quick Takes, and they are just incredible. I think it's some of Lillian's best work.
That's cool.
It's just great. But the Crossbill stuff, deep, deep dive. It's Red Crossbill alone is almost a 40-page account, where there's going to be maps for each call type and even kind of, you know, a stab at foraging charts to help the birder look for crossbills at what time of the year.
And, you know, I want to end with a silly question. And I kind of know the answer, but maybe people don't. Are there left-sided and right-sided crossbills?
There are. There are. And the interesting thing is red crossbill, that ratio is about 1-to-1.
Uh-huh.
And in white wing crossbills, it's 3-to-1. And I always forget, it's the end of the day, I always forget what's the 3-to-1.
Like left-sided or right-sided.
Yeah. Yes. One of them is like, I think it's left over right is 3-to-1 to right over left in white wing. And the belief is that Craig actually did some looking into this, and I think the belief is it has something to do with ability to what they feed on. People don't realize that red crossbills can forage on a lot more of a variety of conifers and actually meet the energetic requirements to breed, whereas white wings can't. White wings really feed on white spruce, tamarack, and black spruce, and sometimes some Doug fir and Sitka and red spruce, but it's really they're really keyed in on the spruces,
the boreal trees, essentially.
Yeah, what white spruce is kind of the universally used conifer for all the crossbills. So,
well, cool, Matt. This has been amazing to just sort of have an expert talk to us about all these things. And I'm sure we're going to come up with more questions for the future when the book rolls out. And thanks so much for talking to us. And I would say
thank you.
Goodbye, everybody. Right.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I look forward to next time.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Bye folks.
Cheers. Bye. All.